Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis today. And we all begin with the good martini, of course. And for that, we go to the first primary results from the 2018 midterm election cycle. The first state up was yesterday. That was Texas. The blue wave is coming, Jim. We talk about this every 2 years. And, of course, we remember from 2014 when the last time the major statewide offices were up, not a single Democrat statewide got 40%, much less won an office. But nonetheless, this is the year of the Democratic wave, which could happen. But it doesn't seem like it's about to happen in Texas, at least not yet. A couple different reports here. First one from NBC News. This is the positive spin for Democrats. While final turnout numbers were not as strong for Democrats as had been suggested by the heavy early voting, more than 1 million Texans cast ballots, the first time the party has topped that figure in the primary since the 2002 midterms. Thanks to Texas's booming population, both parties saw a record number of voters head to the polls. But Democratic turnout was up 84% from the last midterm primary in 2014, while Republican turnout increased about 14%, according to data from the Secretary of State's office. GOP turnout was the highest since 2010. But switch to local KRIS-TV. They say Trump's first term produced a wave of voters Texas hasn't seen in years. Spurred by big numbers in early voting, Democratic voters topped the 1 million mark, a total not seen since 2002. Republicans responded in even larger numbers, passing 1.5 million, breaking the party record of 1.48 million set in 2010. And a lot of people are looking at the Senate primaries, where Ted Cruz got well over a million votes. The Kennedy of Texas, Beto O'Rourke, didn't even get to 500,000. So, Jim, it looks like the Democrats might have to wait. We'll see what happens in a lot of these open House seats in Texas. Maybe they'll pick off one or two. But the idea that the wave is going to come crashing all over Texas appears to be premature yet again.
You know, Greg, I feel like I've heard this story. I've heard this story 4 years ago and 8 years ago and many cycles before then about the great Texas Democratic comeback. And yes, at some year, a Democrat will win a statewide race in Texas. It just doesn't necessarily look like it's going to be this year, and it may be many cycles before that happens. Democrats love this narrative. The national media loves this narrative, and you almost have to sympathize with the reporters down in Texas who would prefer to cover an exciting general election instead of having things basically resolve in the Republican primary. The Democrats did improve their turnout. We should point out it's not that much of an accomplishment to overcome what they did in 2014. Worth noting that, you know, even by the standards of Texas Democrats, 2014 was an abysmal year for them. You may recall the Wendy Davis on the cover of Texas Monthly in her big pink sneakers, and how she was going, you know, she and the issue of securing access to abortion were going to bring Democrats back to power in Texas, and it did not quite turn out that way. In fact, not only did no Democrat win statewide, I got to back and check, but it was something like nobody really passed the mid-40s. Well, you know, most of the races were landslide defeats for the Democrats. So with that as the baseline, the odds are good that Democrats will do better than the worst election cycle they had in recent memory. That's a really low bar to clear, and probably nowhere is the hype to likelihood of victory ratio more out of whack than the coverage around Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who is running against Ted Cruz. Now, to give credit where it's due, Beto O'Rourke does not come across as a crazy left-winger. He has told the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee to stay out. He has done his best to emphasize his differences with Democrats nationally. You know, as far as Democrats go, he's a very amiable, charismatic guy, and, you know, and God bless him. But this is Texas, right? This is a race that Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio and the man who disappeared in the Witness Protection Program. I'm sorry, Department of Housing and Urban Development. Very easy to mix those two up. But basically, Julian Castro took a pass. His brother, the congressman, took a pass. Every other big name Texas Democrat looked at this cycle and said, you know what, it's just not worth it, even building name recognition. And, you know, O'Rourke won the primary. He won the primary with a smaller share of the vote than they expected. And his total votes cast for him was not great. Now, people might say, okay, he's got an issue with name ID. I think Beto O'Rourke is one of those candidates who's more popular outside the state than he is inside the state. You name it, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, Almost every major publication has gone down and done their big profile piece. And I came up with a theory for this, Greg, and I shared this in the Jolt. Right now, we had a little bit of a dusting of snow here in Northern Virginia. They decided not to close schools, which is a small miracle. Greg, would you rather be fighting traffic trying to get into work at Radio America right now? Or would you like to go down to Texas, have some tacos, drink some Shiner Bock, and attend a Beto O'Rourke rally right in the middle of winter? Which sounds more appealing right now?
I'd rather be warm, yeah.
Right? My suspicion is that, you know, Texas is a great place to visit. The food's great. People are friendly. People like going down and writing this piece. And, of course, you can't go back and say, hey, you know, Beto O'Rourke's a pretty good candidate. He'll do better than Wendy Davis, but he's not going to win. You know, because then your editor's like, why did you spend all that money, you know, eating and drinking and spending a week in Texas? So my guess is that you have to write the story as Beto O'Rourke is the Democrats' next great hope. And, boy, if this guy wins, he could instantly become a national player, yada, 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 you know. My guess is we're due for a fairly typical year. You know, you could see Democrats picking off one or two of these congressional races. There are a lot of retirements in the suburbs of Dallas, but you know, they're still pretty Republican leaning seats, Greg. And it is Texas. It's also worth noting, I think it was somebody else was observing this morning, that 2014, huge Republican wave in the midterm elections. Carly Fiorina could not dislodge Barbara Boxer, lost by 10. There are some states you're even in a wave year, you're just not going to see a significant change in numbers. And it looks like, despite the other indicators that are looking good for Democrats, Texas is not a place where they should be expecting any victories anytime soon.
Speaking of significant changes, Jim, let's move to our bad martini now and talk about the latest personnel shift at the White House. Some resignations matter more than others. We didn't really care if Anthony Scaramucci hit the bricks. I believe we spent a good martini on Steve Bannon being shown the door. And obviously, there's been other upheaval besides that. Change at Chief of Staff with Reince Priebus out last summer, John Kelly in. Hope Hicks is out in the last few days. But this one's going to matter more when it comes to policy. This is CNN. President Trump's top economic advisor, Gary Cohn, is resigning. The White House announced on Tuesday. Cohn, who had been rumored just weeks ago as a potential next chief of staff, will leave the White House in the wake of his fierce disagreement with the president's decision to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Cohn is expected to leave in the coming weeks. Quote, Gary has been my chief economic advisor and did a superb job in driving our agenda, helping to deliver historic tax cuts and reforms and unleashing the American economy once again. He's a rare talent, and I thank him for his dedicated service to the American people, President Trump said in a statement. He then tweeted out later that he would be making a decision soon on a replacement and that he will choose wisely, like what happens when you get to the Grail Room at the end of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. So, Jim, this obviously matters more given the significant policy discussions that Gary Cohn was involved in. First of all, this suggests that Trump really is serious about these kinds of tariffs, 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. It makes you wonder a little bit why Cohn would quit, even though it's a major policy difference. It's one major policy difference. Although the fact that Trump basically announced this to the world without consulting with his staff last week might give you some indication as well. So how big of a deal is this, and where do we go from here?
I think it's a fairly significant deal depending on who replaces Cohn. It's very clear that Navarro, a very protectionist voice in the administration, he concurs with Trump and in fact probably encourages Trump's protectionist instincts. And Gary Cohn was the counterbalance. And yesterday, a little bit before the news of Gary Cohn's departure broke, Trump was saying this was how he likes to make decisions. He likes to have strong advocates for differing positions and sometimes diametrically opposed positions. And then in the Oval Office, he gets everybody together and he has them fight gladiatorial games. And whoever wins gets to win the argument. No, I'm sorry. It's not quite like that. But basically, he has, in his mind, good, passionate debates between both sides. So he feels like he's hearing both sides of the argument. In some circumstances, this can be a very good way to reach a decision. You probably all remember the Doris Kearns Goodwin book, Lincoln, Team of Rivals, about Lincoln's cabinet. It appears Trump is kind of emulating this by creeping together a cabinet that is a team of mortal enemies who all can't stand each other. But that apparently, Gary Cohn, you know, he got the tax cuts passed, which was clearly a big agenda item that he agreed with the president on. The problem is when you're the president's chief economic advisor and the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and your job is to put together policy recommendations for the president and make suggestions. And the president just kind of without warning says that he's going to do something that's, completely opposition to what you think is the right case. Doesn't coordinate with the rest of the cabinet, doesn't coordinate with congressional leaders, just kind of blurts it out. Just, you know, doesn't coordinate with, as we understand it, Chief of Staff John Kelly. Then kind of, you know, it's a little bit of that question from Office Space, Greg. What is it you'd say you do here? If you're Gary Cohn, your job is to give the president economic advice, and he doesn't seem interested in listening to your economic advice. And, you know, Gary Cohn may wonder very much why he'd want to stay in the job. We know he's had disagreements with the president in the past. He said he was not happy with the way the president handled the violence in Charlottesville. Now, here's the thing. If you end up replacing Gary Cohn with someone like Larry Kudlow, who is apparently being mentioned as a potential guy, Larry Kudlow, contributor to National Review, also a free trader, somebody who has, I think, been generally and in some cases maybe even, you know, ostentatiously pro-Trump, but who also would be kind of that. Sorry, if you end up replacing Cohn with somebody else who's similarly protectionist, well, then you don't have that team of rivals dynamic. You end up having everybody who's on the same page, which, as much as it might be kind of satisfying to think, oh, okay, administration where everybody agrees on something, they're all pulling their oars in the same direction. You do wonder if that is probably what's best for the president. If you're, you know, skeptical of protectionism like I am, you find this to be a very ominous development. So if you get somebody else who can be that counterbalance to Navarro in there, maybe this isn't such a disaster. But Gary Cohn getting really frustrated and leaving not too long after Hope Hicks and all the other ways that this administration has seemed like a revolving door does not seem reassuring. It does just seem like, you know, the chaos is continuing, and week by week somebody gets voted off of The Apprentice.
Yes, and just to clarify, we're talking about Peter Navarro, not Anna Navarro, as Trump's...
Yeah, like she could get it to the White House.
All right, let's talk about the crazy martini. And Jim, this one's way out there, and unfortunately, I feel like the momentum on the left for this is building. Some folks who are avid readers of National Review may remember, I think it was right around the beginning of the year, NRO editor Charlie Cook wrote a piece about how this movement towards self-driving vehicles was really an effort to curtail our freedoms, our freedom of movement and so forth. And even though we can obviously tell the cars where to go, the car keeps a record, and that's none of the government's business and so forth. And so some people probably read that and wondered, really? Are there really people who want to restrict our movement? Well, yes. Yes, there are. On Twitter, there's a guy with a blue check. That means he's verified. Named David Kleon, I guess is how you pronounce it. I don't know if you are familiar with this guy, Jim, but he says he's been an editor and a writer, and he writes a lot about Russia these days. And he goes off on this really long thread. We'll skip a few of them. He says it is basically immoral to drive. You're going to tell me that many people don't have a choice and or that I sometimes drive, and you're right. So it is immoral not to be politically committed to a world where no one drives. Driving is bad. It should be abolished. Next one. Drinking and driving is bad. Texting and driving is bad, you'll say, maintaining that drinking and texting are the problems. But really, driving is the problem. We've built our cities so people can only get around by polluting the atmosphere and endangering themselves and others. Here is who should have the right to get around in a giant hunk of metal traveling at speeds that will instantly kill a pedestrian, such that tens of thousands die every year and no one notices or cares. No one. No one deserves that right. I can't stop you from driving, but I can expect you to feel bad that you have to. Make every effort not to when it can be avoided, and support policies everywhere that will make it less necessary. And I am impatient for technology to make your car obsolete. To the critics who are arguing that car culture is cool and good, I respect that argument precisely as much as the analogous argument about gun culture. Your hobby inevitably kills and maims innocent people every day. Own that. To the point, I'm privileged. Yes, obviously. In this case, the privilege is that I'm able-bodied and live in the one U.S. city with comprehensive, if flailing, mass transit. But what are you doing to make your city more transit-oriented? What policies are you supporting? There are plenty of legitimate debates to be had about reconfiguring our cities, but they should proceed from two unarguable premises. Cars kill innocent people, and cars are destroying the planet. Start there. No, I don't think you're actually a bad person if you drive a car, to whatever extent is reasonable in whatever context you live. Yes, I also use cars, but I'm trying to get everyone to question the status quo and think about how it could and should change. Last one. I'm an optimist about self-driving vehicles and think the left should be preparing for them now with the goal of fleets of driverless buses and vans and cabs and no more private car ownership in most cities. So there you get to the real crux of it, Jim. They're after private property. They're after your freedom of of movement. They love people all scrunched together, completely dependent on the government to provide them the ability to get around. And I'll tell you what extent is reasonable for me to drive as much as I darn well please.
You know, Greg, next time, you know, you're running around, whether you're picking up groceries, you're running an errand, you know, your kids are a little bit younger than mine at some point running to preschool or something. Just remember that it's a hobby, right? you don't actually need to do all those things. You could just walk to the grocery store and carry all those bags back here and something like that. I actually decided to go look this up when we decided to make this the Crazy Martini. It was back in 2006. It was the Bill Maher program. I was, you know, clicking through, came across it. And the guests included Ian McKellen, the actor, known for a lot of roles, including playing Magneto in the X-Men movies. One of the other guests on the panel was former Congressman Barney Frank. And they got to the topic of gasoline prices. And there was this, you know, general consensus that gasoline was running out. Oil was running out. You know, we can see how that shook out since 2006. Ian McKellen was just like really, really annoyed that everyone needs this. And he said, you know, why is the government really persuading us that we can do something? What's wrong with going on your bicycle? And he goes down this and he says, you know, it takes so long on the traffic. You know, buses are great. Bicycles and walking are better. And it was left to Barney Frank, of all people, to make the argument that, no, people should be allowed to have cars because they need groceries. They need to carry around supplies to work. They have families. You know, the idea of giving up cars. Look, maybe if you're Ian McKellen, you have that option. And if you, you know, if you live car free, great. God bless you. You're one less person in front of me on the beltway when I need to get somewhere. But the flip side of this, like, there are some people who live lives of the mass transit privileged, you could say. You could say that these are the small urban walkable neighborhood privileged people, right? For everybody else who lives in the suburbs or lives in a more rural area or lives a lifestyle in which making a car makes sense, and they don't want to constantly rely on Uber, rely on cabs or anything like that. Look, you know, of course, Uber and cabs are, of course, cars. You're in this idea that, like, these people really seem to resent this idea that you can get in your car and go anywhere you want, which has always been part of this American vision of freedom. It's not surprising that Americans are such a car-crazy country. It's also worth noting, you know, Ian McKellen is a British actor. Look, maybe if you're living in a London neighborhood, one, maybe having a car is a bigger pain and makes no sense. Or, you know, also probably you have a grocery store, a corner bodega or something like that, where you can just walk, grab something and walk back if you need to. Still a hassle, but you can, you know, carry it up the flights of stairs or whatever you need to do. In the case of everybody else, this isn't like that. And it's this, like, failure of imagination. The same way you see in the gun debate, where I was having this argument with someone. They're like, well, look, nobody under 21 should have a gun. And I was like, okay, well, you know, if you're, let's say you're 18, 19, 20, and you got a stalker, and you're afraid that one of these days this stalker is going to show up and, you know, try to harm you. Why are you going to say to a, you know, 18, 19, 20 year old woman, no, you're not allowed to have a gun? I'm like, well, I don't mean in those cases. It's like, well, the reason people need guns is because they have to work the midnight shift at 7-Eleven, and some jobs are dangerous, right? The reason people need cars is sometimes they work in or trucks, and they work construction. They need to carry stuff to the workplace. A lot of these people, because they can't imagine people with different lives, that they want to deny people this other freedom and all that stuff. So I think it is worth pushing back upon this nonsensical idea. No, it's not necessarily mainstream in Democratic circles. But Greg, as we speak of the Crazy Martini, we've seen a lot of crazy ideas that once seemed unthinkable suddenly become quasi-mainstream in the Democratic Party.
No, that's absolutely right. And it's once again the idea of either a-liberal or liberals as a monolith don't like this. So instead of them just deciding not to do it, you can't do it either. There's this, you know, that they've been talking about how NRA TV, for example, doesn't deserve a platform to broadcast. They decide who has the right to speak, who has the right to do all these different things. But because they are woke and the rest of us are not setting aside our privilege, somehow they get to make all the rules. Doesn't work that way.
Anyway, I hope you're listening to this in your car, dear listeners.
Yeah, take a road trip this weekend. That'll show them. Jim, have a good day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.